Hey everyone, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs comes to you live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern, and you can catch us on twitch.tv/wanderingdms or youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about player preparation for a game of D&D. We're going to do a deep dive into the first edition Player's Handbook's climactic section on successful adventures. Does it still have useful lessons for today or not? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get started, I will remind everyone, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host with all of our patrons, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier level, and you'll get an invite to our private Discord server. Get your account over there all set up and good to go before the end of the show, because at about 10 minutes after, Dan and I will be there to talk to you all live.
We love that. We have the best patrons. For example, our patron Backris, who's currently checking in, that we are now live on Twitch and YouTube and Restream. Thank you so much for checking in on that. You know, we've been talking the last couple of weeks about things like West March's campaigns that are more player-directed, player-driven, things like that. And the pacing in conjunction with the players last week, things like that. And every time we talk about that, my mind goes back to the first edition Player's Handbook, which here's my copy, and shall we say that it's well loved. It's a well loved 47-year-old copy.
It looks like that book has seen some things, man.
It's, well, you know, in racing they have a saying of you want to use up all of the car, and I think I've used up all of this book. I think I've got pretty much all the value and more that was provided out of the book. But interestingly, the last section of the book, not counting the appendices, but the last section of the Player's Handbook is this section on, it's titled Successful Adventures, and it's specifically about advanced player preparation. It's a page and a half written by Gary Gygax about if you want to be not a good but a great player, you've got to do this. You really ought to sit down and do this advanced preparation with your party to get ready for the game before you sit down with the DM. And I think it's so interesting that, you know, maybe people are rediscovering some of these tips nowadays, or maybe in some cases they have actually been lost and maybe they're not appropriate for the game nowadays. So I kind of wanted to have a chat with you, Paul, and our viewers about whether they thought this was still appropriate nowadays. How have you dug into this in the past, Paul?
I feel like I've certainly read it in the past. Dug in, I don't know how much I've dug into it in the past. It is a fascinating insight into how Gary was running the game at that time period, I think, and like his attitude towards what the game was about and how to, you know, how it should be played, right? There's not a lot of text in these books about the dynamics of the play group or like just the, you know, like I feel like the books really focus on the nitty gritty of the rules and less so on, well, how do you, I keep just ending with, how do you play, right? How does the game actually play? And I think this is our best insight into that. Viewers, if you're looking at this tiny text that I put up on screen, we don't really expect you to read it. This is where it's in the book, but if you've got your copy of the Player's Handbook open and you're searching for this, look for this lovely image of the big magic mouth. It's right there.
Now, one thing I want to point out in this illustration, which is one of my favorite things ever in any D&D book by the great Dave Trampier, I believe, and it's kind of magically amazing, is that for some reason, and I've had both of these resources for many years, just in the last hour prepping for this, I realized that my actual book and my PDF version of the Player's Handbook that is, you know, authorized by Wizards, and I think I got it off DriveThruRPG a number of years ago, they horizontally flipped this illustration.
Huh. Fascinating.
Why did they do that? Is that just like an error? They horizontally flipped. So, so I believe what I've got in my hands is the original version, and then the PDF version, they flipped it.
That's weird. I have no idea why. That is very...
Was there like a graphic designer that thought it was better like that? I don't know.
Can you find the signature? Like, that's what I wonder about. Is the signature backwards in one of the images? I can't even find the signature.
I think it's snipped out. I actually think... I don't see a signature on the page, so I think that that even in the original version, that was cropped out.
Well,
which is a good
point. It is, as full page illustrations go, you know, it's a nice way to find it. It's also just a lovely callback to the old Magic Mouth spell, which I feel like I've gone back and forth on. Of there was a time when it appeared everywhere and it was just ubiquitous and part of D&D, and then I started to feel like it was overplayed, and so I stopped using it really in any of my games, and now now I'm looking at this image going like, oh yeah, Magic Mouth. I haven't used that in a while. I should take that one back out.
Love it. Love it. Yeah. It starts off like the In Search of the Unknown is like the very first thing you run into. So that's classic memory for me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of those funny things too, where I feel like it's a spell that was listed in the spells section, like any player could memorize it, but really it's for the DM. Like, really,
right?
It is much more for, you know, dressing your dungeon than for a player to actually use in some useful way. I guess, at least I've rarely, if ever, seen a player use Magic Mouth in an interesting way that was helpful to them.
Can anybody, can you, Paul, or any of our viewers name a literary reference for where a Magic Mouth type thing first showed up in our classic D&D canon?
Jeez, no, I couldn't do that. What always jumps into my brain when I think of it is ridiculously the scene from Labyrinth, where the main character is falling and there are all these hands and they form mouths and eyes and
things. Yes. It's
weird. But
you know, the Henson people with their Moomenschantz friends, like that, all that Moomenschantz-y stuff just creeped the crap out of me. And I memory hole that every time they do all that stuff. And my partner Isabel loves it. She'll go, oh, the Moomenschantz stuff is my favorite part of the Muppets. Anyway. We're way off track. I'm thinking there's a Magic Mouth in Paul Anderson's Three Hearts and Three Lions, which gave us the template for the D&D Paladin. They're in the fairy castle, reaches the doorknob, and it turns into a mouth and starts berating the person in question. But we're way off track. Among the things that I love about this section, right, is right off the bat, in the first paragraph, it says, what follows are some basic guidelines as to how good players approach the game. And as continued success tends towards even more achievement, those who play well might actually become great. And so it's an interesting, you know, perspective that we're playing a game where your goal is to beat the dungeon as a team. And it's maybe slightly different than what some players might come to a modern game of D&D now of, like, I want to, you know, have an interesting character and I want to have a romantic relationship and I want a pet and things like that. And the goal is clearly, can you, on like an Olympic level, beat the dungeon? And we can potentially qualify. And this is in an era where tournaments are super important. We ought to be able to qualify a good performance versus a great performance of how you go ahead and beat the dungeon. Clearly, this is the context that this is written in.
It's, you know, there's so many interesting nuggets and so many different ideas that are presented in this, you know, two pages of pretty dense, small font text. I think there's many ways I could take what you've just said there. But I think the first and most interesting element is just, like, should players even do prep, right? Like, I feel like in modern gaming, we come to expect that to be the DM's purview, right? Like, that's part of the DM's job, and there's very little expectation that the players think about the game at all between sessions. All that really is on the player is to show up. And this text definitely suggests otherwise, right? It's trying to push more responsibility on the player, and I've always wondered, deep down, is this Gary talking about the way it was or the way he wished it was?
Great. Me too. 100%. 100%. And partly, you know, this and some of his other writings always whet my appetite for, I want to see a game like that. Oh, that would be great. To have players as a team come in and be organized and be like, we're going to do this. And we've optimized all of our spells and our equipment and our encumbrance and our movement just for this particular goal. And I want to see that. I've never seen that. Admittedly, I've never experienced that. So one of his writings that's aspirational? Trying to get people to do this, to take some load off him with his copious number of sessions that he's running? What a great question.
It is a fantastic idea at its core, and one that is, like, I will say, as DM, yes, I love seeing when players have bothered to prepare, right? Like, or even just be motivated, right? If players are simply, and it doesn't even have to be all of them, a couple of them, one or two of them. This is exactly what we were talking about. We have one or two highly engaged players who are motivated to talk about, analyze, prepare, even if it's just like mental preparation of what are we going to do? I think that just lifts the game so much.
Agreed. And think about, some people are, I guess sometimes people use the term beer and pretzels game. It is a game. It's a recreation. I certainly have players in my Friday night sessions where they've had a long work week. They've maybe had a stressful week. They've had a long day, and this is their opportunity to kick back with friends. Is this something, is this a hobby that most people or everybody wants to, like I understand, like with Magic the Gathering, there's the meta game, right? We're prepping for our strategy. If you're a top chess player, you're going to be studying openings and end games and things like that. Do most people want to do that for our fantasy role playing? In my limited data set, mostly not, frankly. They want to come and they want to be, entertained for this session. And you can also think about nowadays, obviously, we have so many more options for communication. It's trivial for, a Discord group, an email server, multiple things. Well, this was written in 1978 where none of that existed. Your options were postal mail or one-on-one phone call.
Yep.
That's it. That's all you had. At the time this was written, this would be monumentally more difficult to actually execute on and much, much, trivial today, and it still doesn't happen. So maybe this, maybe... Maybe just one or two people is all you can hope for.
I think there's a third option, right? Which is just we're friends who get together in addition to outside the game, right? Like in addition to getting together for the game, we also get together occasionally for dinner or, drinks down at the bar, and the game comes up and we discuss it. Right?
Like, I completely didn't think about that. Friends? Really? You what? What an interesting concept, Paul.
Possible.
I ought to look into that more.
Just say, in 1978, that would have worked for them.
A note on that. Right. That's my to-do list.
I'm fully all for like anything that can be done in the game or anything outside the game in a meta level to promote players to have that kind of energy to think about the game at least a little bit, do some of the prep work. And again, I don't necessarily think it's contrary to players who want like a relaxing, fun activity with their friends. Plenty of things, right, that people do together that they then talk about when they're not doing that thing, right? Like there's certainly plenty of leisure activities where I'm sure people, did you see the game last night? Right? Like, yeah, they both like watching football and they like talking about having watched football, right? Like it's a
totally. Totally. And there's a whole agreed.
It takes a little load off the DM, right? Because like just knowing, having that information, the players are interested in XYZ, it helps focus us. Maybe if they're willing to take on a little bit of the logistics, it's really nice. And I'm all for it.
And again, this is this West March's style that we're seeing Critical Role run with their current season. So it's that's very much an expectation.
I think this is the part of West March's that Critical Role doesn't do at all, is my theory. Is going to be my theory. Right.
Okay.
Right. They're all doing right. the big continuous world, you know, sandbox style thing. They're doing the lots of players thing, but are the players self-organizing or are they being directed how to organize?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't, not enough information for me yet, but my gut says they're not really self-organized.
So in this section, there are, and it's easy to miss, partly because of the way, you know, things are organized and edited at the time. There are 7 italicized recommendations, and sometimes they're kind of deep into a paragraph that's there, it's not easy to actually spot them. There's 7 italicized recommendations, and I'd kind of like to go through the 7 and think about what how useful they would be for our game today. So number 1 is set an objective. And I mean, I feel like this is very much the West Marches thing, right? Number 1 is set an objective. It's get together, talk to the players. Actually, what it specifically says is it says at least talk to the better players so that you will be able to set an objective for the adventure. And this could be get to the second level or find the stairs or destroy this ancient artifact or wreck this shrine or steal this treasure or something like that, but have a specific objective. And then once that's been set, do we have the resources for it? What spells are we going to take? What equipment are we going to take? Do we need to hire henchmen to bolster our party for this? But the number, and most of this other advice is going to be keep focusing on that objective. Useful?
I do like the set of objective thing. And I'm not even sure. I almost think you could take that to the extreme and say, does the DM even need to be involved in that? Or is just the objective needs to be delivered to the DM? This is our objective. This is what we're doing.
Yeah.
I think it's great.
How do you feel? So I guess the West March's recommendation is like, you know, initially was tell the DM at least, I don't know, 3 days, I think, was the original thing. At least a couple days in advance so that DM can prepare for it. What I have had, I think at least once or twice, is I've had players secretly pick a goal and intentionally not inform me about it so they could show up in the game and go, hey, Dan, guys, we're doing this, and we know you don't have any time to prep for it, so it should be easier than if you set up a bunch of obstacles for us.
What a jerk move.
I points for that.
You're for it?
I give points for it. That's ballsy and I like it.
That's funny. The interesting thing is you can't, even the information you delivered to the GM doesn't necessarily have to be the actual objective, right? It could be the first step towards the objective, right? You could do something where you're saying like, we want to remove this curse that's on one of our players. We think that there is a powerful magic that will help them in this dungeon. And so they deliver to the DM, we're going to go explore this dungeon, right? The DM certainly has plenty to prepare there without really necessarily knowing that the player's goal is to find the thing that removes the curse. But now you're relying on, I don't know what the play there is from the players of like whether that's wise or not. Right, like if we tell the GM our goal is to remove this curse, then depending on GM whim, there may or may not be a thing in there that removes that curse. Right, if you by not telling him, you're relying on the fact that like we think we've gained enough information that we know what is actually there, and the GM isn't going to change it.
Got it. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Now you're getting into like the just the social dynamics of reading the DM. How much? And that's a weird thing, right? And different groups are gonna really hew different directions on this part of it, right? Like some groups are gonna say, no, you should absolutely tell the DM because the whole point is together to craft a storyline that we all enjoy and like we should, and so it should be obvious, and the DM should absolutely include the removal of the curse in that dungeon. And then other groups will say, no, the game is about exploration and discovering the unknown. And so we absolutely don't want to talk about it because we want to find out for ourselves what is there and is not there.
Right.
And GM should be this impartial judge who has the information about what is there is already set. And we're either going to find out if we're right or wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the emphasis here is that they can pick reliably specific things I think they know about. And I do agree that that might possibly challenge some people's expectations of, I want to be surprised. I want to go into a place and be surprised on a regular basis. And that's a little bit counter to this advice, frankly. A lot. We'll get to it. There's a bit at the end that specifically says the better the players get, the more the DM can ramp up the challenges. But we'll get to that later. So if you mm-hmm. do this play, you're also engaging in increasing the likelihood of your own demise. But we'll that's at the end. So number two thing here is survival at lower levels is usually dependent upon group action and team spirit. And they make a caveat for higher levels. And it says like when you get to like 9th or 10th level, maybe just like one or two players can come hire a bunch of henchmen and that's all you need. But at least when you're starting out to just live, just have your character live through it, you must be cooperating with the whole party. And really think about and it highlights spell users. Make sure that you can complement the rest of your party's equipment, magic items, spells that you're picking for this particular session. And one thing it says, and this is something that I had to relearn at a late era as a player, it says characters must know each other's strengths and weaknesses, physical and mental, in order to meet the problem posed with the correct character or combination thereof. And I know that for quite a while, my instinct, and I think other people's, are you want it to play out like a movie or a TV show where we're in a terrible situation and then someone surprises everybody. Oh, I have the perfect solution. Ha ha, with a spell or a magic item and nobody knew about it. And it's the perfect thing. And basically that's a recipe for disaster if you try to actually play that out as a player character. So in a embarrassingly late era, we, and you were part of this group, Paul, and our friend BJ, had to remind ourselves, don't keep resources secret. Make it known at the start of the session so that everybody can plan and expect for that. But that's it. But again, that's just one part of the survival is dependent on group action, team spirit.
That's interesting, and I feel like that aspect of like declaring what your abilities are is maybe more important in the kind of convention and one-off sessions that we've been doing more so in our older age, right? Whereas like when you're playing a long-running campaign, you're more exposed to the other players and like you have more experience with them, so you're probably more likely to be able to predict what they can and can't do because you've seen it, right? You're not gonna surprise cast a fireball when I've seen you cast that fireball six times already, right?
Good point.
Yeah. Not to say that it's not valid. I think it is a valid idea of like yes, teamwork. I think ultimately what Gygax is kind of underscoring here is what I think. I can't remember if this is in Finch's Old School Primer or not, but the general concept of player skill is more important than character skill, right? That the emphasis of the game is in us coordinating and outthinking the dungeon rather than relying on, oh, ta-da, I have the perfect ability or spell or whatever to handle this problem.
I'm interested in his...
This is interesting to me that he then undercuts that and says, like, oh, but at high level, none of this matters. Screw it. I'm like, does that mean your progression is maybe broken? Is there something wrong with the game that the reward for getting more powerful is you don't get to play the same game anymore?
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, to my understanding, that is how things kind of played out for him, is that he had, I don't know, maybe his favorite players would get more time with Gary, maybe could come over with their, super high-level character and get some extra play in. But it's certainly counter to my expectation. I wouldn't plan on doing that.
And my point is, right, if you dig into that and you say, this is a feature, right, this is a feature of the game, right, the game, D&D, it encourages collaborative lateral thinking, right, it encourages teamwork, and it encourages you to, not just rely on statistics and actually, like, cooperatively with your friends come up with clever solutions to problems. Until you've played it for a long time, then get rid of your friends because you don't need them anymore. Like, why is my reward for playing the game well? I don't get to engage in those activities anymore. Like, that seems weird.
Fair. Yeah, fair. I'll also say that this is this little bit is the part where it says here that as you make preparations, your characters should like hide their treasure, have a henchman guarding their, you know, their stronghold or whatever. And you really got to make out a will. Right. It says, and a will, a will of some sort written out. So the DM will not balk at the arrangements made to assure the smooth transition of goods to the devoted relative, quote unquote, of the defunct character of those souls three should ever come to pass. And they mention a will in original D&D before this. And the first edition player character sheets famously had a built-in section for my last will and testament that you fill out. And it's always a little bit coy, but it seems like the implication is clearly as you play and you gain some magic items and you gain some treasure, that part of the character can always just be shifted to your new character at the outset through this will technique. And that's obviously something that got expunged from the game in later editions, but I'm kind of pleased to find it in this section right here. That should be part of your advanced preparations is your will.
It almost feels like some player pulled this on Gary by surprise at some point and like, well, aha, I've written, my character may have died, but I've written a will and all my things get passed on to my nephew. And I just imagine, I'm sure I'm completely projecting here, but I'm just imagining Gary looking at that and being like, that's clever. Yes. Yes, not only does that happen, but now I'm writing it into my book. You should do this. Everyone should do this. It's very clever.
Yeah. I agree. That does feel quite that does feel quite likely, you're right. And we've done stuff like that. When I had the player be like, "Can we use if we recorded the clue? Can we use the recording the clue?" And everybody yelled at him like, "Why are you wasting time on this?" And he says, "Because I recorded the clue." Because when Dan read it, I recorded that part. I'm like, "Yes. Yes, you get to use that, sir."
Brilliant.
Moving on. Okay, number three of seven is a map is very important because it helps assure that the party will be able to return to the surface. And they go into thing, and it says, this doesn't need to be a square perfect. If it's off by 10 or 20 feet, that's not the point. The point is avoid the dead ends, get back to the surface. It recommends actually having two people make two separate maps. And it also has a section on, if you get chased and you're running, you won't be allowed to map. So then you ought to have some pre-planned turn left, turn right, turn left, turn right, so you can easily get back to your map section or not. So this is a thing that I'm accustomed to. Some people want to get away from this nowadays, don't want that to be part of the game. What do you think, Paul?
I think this is a part in this text where Gary gets into some nitty gritty here, where he's definitely assuming a very specific style of play, right? Dungeon, right? Which he talks about in the very beginning, like dungeon exploration, what most of this is about, right? And there's a general attitude throughout this text, I think, of this push towards you are a tactical unit, right? And your group is training on these very, very specific tactics of how to accomplish this very specific kind of challenge. And that's what the game is about. I don't want to deny any of that and say the game is not about that. It is, right? And it's a great part of the game. I just want to push back on that a little bit and say the game doesn't have to only be that. That there is a lot of other aspects of playing D&D or other RPGs that I enjoy that this just excludes. I might want to step back a little and say, how can I genericize that a little bit? I might say, like, taking notes is important. Like, take notes, right?
Nice.
You know, whether that's your a physical map of the location you're exploring or notes about the people you're meeting or whatever, you know, leaving bound and then tying that into like these are in-game artifacts. My character keeps a journal and I will pass it. I will include my journal in my will of how it gets passed along. Not bad. I like all that stuff. Is a map super important when you're exploring an underground dungeon? For sure. Yeah, it is. You need redundancy, you know, two people drawing maps. I've literally never seen it happen. Not once.
Yeah. I think maybe I have.
Yeah.
I think I have actually seen... I have seen that, actually. Maybe with, like, a larger group with, like, nine people. I actually have seen that. And it actually, I think that actually has come in play once. I think I actually have destroyed someone's map and go, ha ha, you're lost. And then someone else went, well, I have mine. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. I did not know that was happening. And the players did actually get one over on me by doing that once.
Yeah. I mean, I have seen cases, I guess, where one player is keeping like a very detailed graph paper map and another player is just writing very like loose point to point notes with just lines and circles, but it's still enough to navigate by. And then I've also seen a funny thing, which Gary points out, as I've seen a case where a player, where I've played with a player who just has amazing spatial memory, and they just remember it all. And he talks about that a little bit in his text, and these people exist. I've played with them,
okay,
who could just like close his eyes and think hard and go, yep, we go left and then right again, and then left and then right, and he just completely visualized the 3D, the 2D layout of the map perfectly in his head.
Like, wow.
Right. You do exactly
that. That's novel. That would be a new thing for me. I haven't run that. Let me throw up a really great comment here that we just got from Stephen Kennedy, who we're talking about mapping here, and Stephen saying, well, unless you've been teleported. Well, interestingly, Gary has a final point about this. And I actually love the way it's written. It says, if transported or otherwise lost, begin mapping on a fresh sheet of paper and check for familiar or similar places as you go along. Never become despondent. Fight until the very end. And that really hits me. I that really warms my heart. There was a day a couple weeks back in bowling where I was at the line and behind a little bit, and one of the people on the other team just yelled out, he never quits. I'm like, maybe that's where I got that from a little bit. I don't that's mind funny. That as life advice.
I mean, be tenacious. Why not? It's hard to argue against that one, Dan.
That's right. I love your perspective of like how to generalize this actually past the specific, this particular getting through a labyrinth type play, but yeah.
I'm glad you enjoy that, because I was like, oh no, this is the part I thought that maybe you and I were going to butt heads on, is like when he gets, there's certain parts of this text, man, where Gary's military background is just showing, right? Like whether that's the influence of wargaming, or was he actually in the military? I can't remember. But like, it has this very heavy dose of like, military command, tactical, mentality, which, do I want that in my games? Not necessarily.
And his players at the time, I mean, many or most of them were, veterans from either World War II or Korea, or at least in the National Guard or reserves or something like that. And they all brought, that sensibility and that, and enjoyed that play style, frankly.
I'm not trying to say that it's not good, and I'm not trying to say that they clearly didn't do it right. Like I'm sure it was very appealing to the gang that he had back in the mid 70s. And even if they didn't have direct military experience, they were certainly all wargaming, right? That's the whole hobby. Yes, grew up out of wargaming, so they're used to this kind of structure. Great. Good for them. And I don't necessarily always want. I think that there's a certain amount of that. A little bit of it can be fun, especially if we're specifically role-playing that. If we're role-playing a group who is acting as a military unit or something, that can be a little fun. But it could go too far for me.
Interesting. I might have more taste. I guess I might have more taste for it partly as an educational exercise. And it's interesting that he used I think the phrase was like, make sure you pick the right spells and equipment and so forth, and the right characters to solve the problem posed. And it really makes me think of what's the name of like Outward Bound or something like that? These programs specifically to generate team, esprit de corps, team building exercises. And I actually don't mind D&D partly as education in team building, problem solving is not something I hate, frankly. So I might have a little bit more appetite for the game in this kind of mode, frankly, than some people. But if I'm the DM, you don't get to pick. That's what's happening. Okay, next part is two italicizations in the same paragraph, and it's avoid unnecessary encounters. And so again, having picked this initial goal, be ruthless about laser pursuing that particular goal, avoiding other distractions. It advises not engaging with wandering monsters, because that's just a distraction from your goal. Wandering monsters typically weaken the party. Very few are going to be helpful. And it says here, run first and ask questions later is the advice for dealing with wandering monsters. Now, I will confess, I don't think I've never seen a party that took that tactic. If a monster shows up, and I think, you know, partly it's like the game is we go in a dungeon, we fight monsters, right? So at least one person always runs to engage the wandering monster. And then, you know, to their credit, the rest of the party feels compelled to support that person. And so I think very close to 100% of wandering monsters get engaged in my games.
And I think this is kind of where the original game comes at odds with sort of modern sensibilities, right? That like,
yeah,
in the modern game, it is much more about fighting monsters, and the monsters are there to be fought, and that's the point. And probably the DM put a lot of energy into the encounter, right? And it's less likely, oh, I just rolled some goblins on a chart, and more likely, no, I crafted this intricate set piece with this map and this battle map, and I have these miniatures, and et cetera, at which point you're like, you know, it, just avoiding it is just mean, right? I'm just, you know, all that hard work the DM put in, I'm just tossing it aside. And again, I just think it's just that pointing out, I think, how different the games are and how different their point is, right? This is certainly something we see in Finch's, I keep forgetting the name of his
old school primer.
The old school primer, right. This is certainly in his old school primer, right? That the game was originally more about exploration, not about combat. The more modern games are more about the tactical combat.
Yeah, and I think part of what you're saying is, I mean, we certainly have friends that have expunged wandering monsters and said wandering monsters just don't make any sense for the coherent story that I'm trying to tell. Therefore, every monster you run into is presumably a preset crafted encounter.
Right, and because they want to put that level of energy into it, right? Like, mm-hmm. if we're going to spend 2 hours of our game session staring at a battle mat with these you know, well painted minis and, you know, carefully crafted terrain or at least well thought out, even if it's just on a wet erase battle mat, even still just like, no, I thought out what this encounter is going to be like, and it's more of set PC. Then why would you toss that away, right? That's something you carefully crafted and put in place on purpose. As opposed to, like I said, most wandering monsters, literally, it's just a random roll. Just, this thing happened, right? You're traveling from point A to point B. I have to roll the dice 3 times, and this time it came up a one. So I'll roll on this chart. Oh, it's 6 goblins. Go.
Well, in the original game, that is a test. Yeah.
Avoiding.
Yeah. Avoid. Yeah. It's in the original game, that is a test of party discipline. Do they have the capacity as a group to all say, yes, we run away? The next thing in the same paragraph, on the same point, frankly, number 5, is do not be sidetracked. And the interesting note here is a good referee will have many ways to distract an expedition, many things to draw attention, but ignore them if at all possible. The mappers should note such thing, and maybe another expedition will be in order another day to investigate or destroy the whatever. Do not be sidetracked. Now, I think I was reading on, I think, Blue Sky maybe a week or two ago, someone running a current game, and the party ran into some kind of boss, wizardy, cleric-y type thing. And at the outset of the engagement, the boss said, "You are so easy to distract. The dumbest ruse will always distract you. Here are my minions who are now going to destroy you." And in comes some goons, and the party fights them. And at the end, it turns out that the ritual that the bad guy was trying to get done in the next room had been completed because the players had been, in fact, distracted by the monsters that came in. The boss literally explicitly told them that at the outset, that that was happening, and the players all, like, smacked themselves on the head, like, oh my god, he literally said that he was going to distract us, and it absolutely worked. So,
that's hilarious.
I can imagine a critique here of like why, you know, why have interesting, enticing things in the game in order and then tell players that they need to avoid them.
Well, it also it sets up the relationship between DM and player in an unusual way, let me say. Right? I mean, there's certainly lots of stories of the old school killer DM. And I think this is just a slight variation of that, where it's really like the DM is attempting to hinder you, to hamper your progress towards your goal.
Yes.
Like in an almost kind of like impishly, you know, malicious way, right? I'm like, ha, 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 players, you idiots. Which, like, I don't know. Is that
impish?
Is that really? I don't know. It's a little weird for me because, and frankly, it's part of just the paradox of DM. Is that you're there to challenge the players, and but you also enjoy seeing them succeed. So there's a weird. I feel like too far down this road, you get stupid stuff like earworms.
Yes.
And
sure.
Rust monsters and
yeah.
You know, and all the other million stupid things that are like, ah, the players figured out this trick. I'm going to counter them with this ham-fisted thing.
I'm not a big wrestling fan traditionally, but we keep brushing up against the energy of like pro wrestling. And when I was young, I would hear, you know, people that play the villains, you know, maybe possibly like Andy Kaufman probably talked about this more than some other people of like, I really enjoy people hating me. I really love 10,000 people in an arena screaming for my head to be ripped off. That's great. I'm like, what kind of insanity is this? And then, you know, a couple decades go by. I'm like, that's what I'm doing. That's what I'm doing as a DM. funny point. Number six, after Don't Get Sidetracked, is if the party becomes lost, the objective must immediately be changed to discovery of a way out. And they go into the and part of this is, so again, focus on that goal. I always think about this. If you get lost now, because you might, you're possibly queuing up for a TPK in traditional D&D. You get lost, you're in a dead end, you're cut off. This might be easily the end. And one of the things here is it says it is of utmost importance to always carry slain members with the party, if at all possible. So maybe even if you lose a single character and that burdens you down because you're required to carry that character, maybe you should just leave at that point.
Yeah. Again, I feel like this is getting very much into the nitty gritty of good tactics for dungeon crawls. Okay. Yep. I don't disagree. I don't know that it's at the same level of importance of some of the earlier points of just like player engagement and goal setting and note keeping.
I think I actually feel really warm towards this one of like, if you get lost, now you got to get out, because I think that is particularly for new players, they might not realize the extreme lethality that they're in if they get trapped. And they might just go, oh, well, that's an interesting little funny thing that just happened, and kind of witlessly plunge deeper into the dungeon when they don't have the resources to do that. And when if they haven't seen a TPK before in their life, they might not realize that that's a potential, you know, thing that's allowed to happen. And I can see advice like that of like, you are possibly not going to lose one character. You might lose all the characters right now if you are trapped and cut off. So you really need to bear down and focus on that to survive, frankly. So this is probably the number one thing that I probably remember from this section on a day-to-day basis of get the hell out.
Yeah.
Now, number seven, and maybe for some people this might be, and this is actually the longest, this actually goes for two paragraphs here. The last one is, cooperation assumes mutual trust and confidence. And it says, this is enhanced when members are certain that the survivors will do their best to see that any slain character is carried forth from the dungeon to be resurrected, if at all possible. All members of the expedition should be ready and willing to part with any goods, money, and magic items in order to save lives. Failing that, each should be willing to fight to the death to assure the survival and success of the party. This will happen when mutual trust exists. And so for me, this kind of like, and again, this is very much in the ballpark of this military squad. We leave no brother behind, no brother or sister. And, you know, where I see a big difference, and this has been since day one, this is not a new thing, is when players make their new characters and their first instinct is, I need to make some kind of antagonism among the members of the party to drive the drama or the narrative of the story. And we're going to have some kind of, maybe dueling brothers or something like that, right? And they think that the antagonism and the drama has to be in the party, when this is hammering in the strongest possible terms is you've got to be completely devoted and dedicated to each other. The game is that hard, and there's enough threat all around you that this is your only option for survival.
It's it's angling towards a very specific style, right? A very specific, and I still feel like we're deep in that military attitude of this is a game about exploration, infiltration, extraction, right? And like, okay, that's the game you want to play. I think there's more to D&D than just that.
Seriously, I think it's helpful
I think there's room for a game that has lots of inter-party tension and drama, and that can be fun as well. Possibly, I might add, you should be explicit about which kind of game you're playing up front, right? Set the tone, set the expectation. Talk about this up front, right? Because the worst is when you've got a couple players who are anticipating, we are a band of siblings who will fight to the death for each other and no man left behind and et cetera, et cetera. And then you've got another player who's going like, aha, but I have my own secret motivations and I'm going to screw you all when we're at the worst possible moment. It'll be dramatic and exciting.
Well, I feel like that's what this section is doing. They put it in the player's handbook, specifically, I think, to try to scope out what this current game is intended to be. And the next paragraph deals with exactly the thing you just mentioned, Paul, but what if there's another player doing something else? And the next paragraph, first of all, says, even if there's characters of evil alignment, they should be incentivized to still work for the party and still sacrifice for the greater party good in this particular limited situation. And it says other people, who don't do that, how are you going to handle that? Let me see. So it says, okay, now chaotic evil ones, they're prone to be troublesome and hurtful. Selfish neutrals are going to be similar to those evil characters. I mean, hopefully you can meet their price basically. And then it says, the character of good alignment, who is basically uncooperative, often acting as an evil or selfish neutral, would is another matter. For such players usually join under the pretense of being helpful and willing to act in the best interest of the party. Undoubtedly, this is the part we're really going to debate. Undoubtedly, the best way to take care of such players is to expel them from the group as soon as circumstances permit. Do this as often as is necessary to either change the player's mind about cooperation or until he or she becomes tired of having their characters consigned to oblivion because of their attitude. Is that... Yep. Now, so that's a very old school way of handling what we'll call interpersonal conflict or whatever. And, me as a kid reading this at the time, I didn't have any other perspective, frankly. I took that heart. And it, certainly, I think we can agree nowadays there's other tools for handling that.
The interesting thing to me here is that, you know, it gets into this part of just like the social dynamics of the group, which I think is fascinating, right?
Yeah.
And he takes this very hard line around just essentially eliminating players from your playgroup, right? Which seems harsh. But also, I can't help but notice how much he blurs the line between the personality of the player and character sheet, specifically their alignment, right?
Yeah.
And he's just, I feel like he's just absolutely setting us up for, I'm just playing my character. Dan, I'm just playing my character. I am lawful evil. I'm just playing my character. You shouldn't be mad at me. And that's just like the worst kind of play.
Excellent point. And for me, they're a little bit sloppy. I mean, they're a little bit sloppy ways. I noticed that the very first line of this paragraph I'm looking at right now, the language is intelligent players of evil alignment should do this, right? It doesn't say player characters of evil alignment. It actually says intelligent players of evil alignment should still be ready to help others to further their own ends. And for me, I think that he's dancing towards the idea of we should just prohibit evil characters. He's kind of torn between, I want all these options on the table, like I want Magic Mouth on the spell list, even though players don't really want that. I want all the different alignments to be eligible on the menu. I want to be able to say you can do anything in this game, but at the same time, you have to make up these kind of ridiculous boundaries around the evil characters and why they still kind of work good anyway. When he could, you know, he's very close to saying we should just prohibit evil player characters, but he doesn't want to get quite to that point yet.
But I feel like it's still an excuse to use game mechanics to enforce interpersonal decisions when you really should just be an adult and talk to people like adults, right? Like, should you only play with the people you would get along with and want to play with? Yes, of course. If you have issues with someone on a personal level and you don't get along, maybe don't play D&D with that person. That is fine. Right. But, like, saying, like, oh, well, it's fine. Everyone's welcome at the table, but I'm just going to be a dick to you so that eventually you'll stop showing up, you know? Or I think also what we're getting at here is some of the stuff I pointed out that just naturally happens, possibly to the detriment of the West March's style, is you end up with clicks.
Right.
And then people start to exclude each other. And so I feel like that nature of that style of organization, Gygax would probably point to that and say, that's a feature. That's how you get rid of the bad players. They just stop getting invited to the game.
Yeah.
And like, that sucks, man. There's just treat people like humans. Come on.
I will say, I mean, maybe I need this. Maybe I'm bolstering. I'm bolstering my courage to say a certain thing when this comes up, and the advice to have the conversation. I think I do have to confess that there are certain subcultures. Maybe where I grew up was one of them. Maybe that generation before me is one of them, and I grew up with older. I worked in the fields with older farmers. I'm currently in a bowling group, frankly, where I'm by far the youngest person in the group, oddly. And some of those older gentlemen of that generation do not have that let's have a conversation in their DNA. They just don't have it. And in my limited experience attempts that I've had to have conversations with some of those people always go off the rails, is always taken poorly, and turns into, frankly, a distressing argument. So if you have cultivated a circle of really great people, like I know you have, Paul, and you can have the adult conversation, that's, I think, ideal. And then there are, you know, maybe, you know, Gary was in a mix where that just wasn't part of their culture. And this is all they had. And this is how they went through the world.
Yeah, I don't disagree with any of that. We have a really nice comment here from Yes Mana Burn, which I'm going to put up here. I don't. It might be too long to fit in our little text box here. It is, but I'll read it out. It says, I think Gary's functionally right about the problem, but of course not about the solution, which shouldn't be slap down the player's character until they shape up. It should, of course, be have an adult conversation and get on the same page. You know, I think I totally agree with that. I think it's unfortunate that Gary's attitude made it here into the page. You know, we're all flawed in one way or another, Dan, right? We all, you know,
more than one, maybe a multitude.
There's a lot to like, frankly, in Gary's text here, and there's a lot. There's some good advice, and there's some really nice insights just how the game was played amongst him and his players. And then there's some occasional things where I'm just going to have to say, I disagree with you, Gary. I'm not going to do it that way.
Yeah. We're standing on the shoulders of giants, and hopefully we can do even better.
Yeah. We are out of time, Dan, unfortunately. I was excited to talk about the social contract part. We barely managed to slip it in there towards the end. Do you have any final thoughts on player prep?
I think we agree that this is specific to this very take no prisoners, explore a dungeon style at the time. And I am enticed by it. And like I say, I like D&D partly as an educational opportunity to in team building, in problem solving, and how can we confront overwhelming adversity as a small group of people that depend on each other closely. I think that that's an important and useful skill in the world. It continues to be today. So I don't mind having games like that. And it's certainly been a big benefit in my life to have an opportunity to reflect on what that kind of confrontation with evil would look like. Granted, if you embrace a play style like that, I really like this focus on team building, complete devotion to the people that you're fighting with, focus on a goal, even though when you're getting distractions around you, and if you get cut off and trapped, get out. Those are things that frankly make a difference, and I don't mind having particularly new players reminded about that. I think it's a really good opportunity for that, frankly.
Yeah, I would say I feel like I can definitely see where a lot of this came out of. You know, this part of this text fuels my theory, right? That AD&D was really trying to be the authoritative rule book to solve the tournament issues, right? So it needs to lay down this kind of attitude, I think. I don't want to say that style of play is unpleasurable, and there is some cases where I would enjoy and do enjoy playing that way. And my only counter argument, I think, is just that I think that the hobby of role playing and even just D&D itself has become bigger than what is on display here. That this is a subset now, and so I would hate to read this text and go, "This is the one true way that you must always play D&D." It is a way that can be quite fun. I would just make sure you're on the same page with everybody you're playing with, and you'll have a good time.
Wise. I think that's wise. Super nice.
Viewers, if you have thoughts on player prep, what you think your players should or wish your players were doing to prepare for D&D games, or thoughts on Gygax's section here labeled Successful Adventures in the back of the first edition AD&D Player's Handbook, please leave us a comment here in the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you, and perhaps we will have a follow-up conversation fueled by your very thoughts.
And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites, so please look for us there and marshal that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. Also, through various third-party podcast carriers such as iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to the show right now on one of those sites and it offers the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, thanks to our patrons who support the show. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Every tier gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversation continues 24/7 about old school D&D, new school D&D, horror games, the whole panoply of role-playing that's available nowadays. Just like Paul said at the top of the hour, in about 10 minutes, we'll be there to continue this conversation with more of your thoughts in our live video after chat. So if you are a patron, jump in there, and we would love to see you this Sunday for what you're thinking about in advanced preparation, and whether these old school things are still useful today. We're back next week. Is that what we said, right, Paul? We're back next Sunday.
Yes. Yes, we will be back next Excellent. Sunday. I will be on the road, so you may see an unusual background behind me, but I should be able to.
Got it. A little wandering, we like that. I'll be eager to see where Paul winds up next week. So we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, and we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see.